Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Tuesday, May 18th, Joe Azoff and Ray Graff and Allen were joined by investigative journalist and New Albany adjunct Professor Rosemary Armeo, Cohoes City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
The Supreme Court agreed Monday to a showdown over abortion in a case that could dramatically alter nearly 50 years of rulings on abortion rights. The court is taking on a case about whether states can ban abortions before a fetus can survive outside the womb. Mississippi is asking to be allowed to enforce an abortion ban after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It's not asking to overrule the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, but abortion rights supporters said that case is a clear threat to abortion rights. The case probably will be argued in the fall. Decision is likely maybe spring of 2022, which would, of course, be during the campaign for congressional midterm elections. Mississippi's ban had been blocked by lower courts as inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent that protects a woman's right to obtain an abortion before the fetus can survive outside her womb. The central question in this case, Rosemary Armeo, is one of viability, whether a fetus can survive on its own at 15 weeks. The state argues viability, a very arbitrary standard. What do you make of this, and what ramifications are we seeing?
Well, it's a disastrous law if it goes into effect. You'd have to realize you're pregnant, set up an appointment, and get an abortion all within the first 15 weeks. Many women don't even realize, especially at first pregnancy, that they're pregnant at that early an age. So it will drastically cut down the number of abortions that that women can actually even set up in time. It's an assault on Roe v. Wade, and it won't be the last one. We saw it coming, and now it's here. I'm not surprised. The only way to really deal with this, if you're a feminist, is to argue for laws that will change the basis on which the Supreme Court is acting. This is 50 years of precedent now that the Supreme Court appears very willing to throw out the window. Amy Coney Bryant is certainly one of the members who voted for this. She is an avid anti-abortionist. And we're seeing the culture wars come into the court. I think it's a terrible, terrible omen. And oddly, so unneeded. Abortions have never been at a lower number in this country. It's not as if there's some flood of these abortions that it has to be controlled in this draconian way. I hope legislatures act. I hope women and feminist groups, I already sent in my donation. I think this is a danger to women everywhere. And it's not accompanied by any good signs, like a new and enlightened view on contraception, which would really eliminate the need for abortion if it were done correctly. It's just, we're going back to the dark ages.
Alan Chartok, Rosemary alluded to this and mentioned Amy Coney Barrett, the conservative majority now on the Supreme Court. What do you think this portends for this case?
Well, I do believe that Rosemary is right about every word she just said. What we have now, we saw it with Franklin Roosevelt when he became the president. We have a court that is out of sync with much of America. It is, as Rosemary said, a disaster. And it may have to be solved with a very tough stance on the part of the American people and the Congress and the president in terms of whether or not to expand the Supreme Court, which nobody really wants to do. But there has to be some way that we can signal that we can't have a dictatorship coming from six of the nine members on the Supreme Court that is so antithetical to a woman's right to control her own body.
You know, Teresa Bourgeois, one angle the Biden administration is taking, and again, Rosemary mentioned this briefly in her opening comments, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the Biden administration backs legislation that would write Roe into federal law regardless of the outcome of this case. Teresa.
Yes, and I agree with that, Ruud. I, Alan, with all the respect, I'm not in the, and I'm not sure you are either, but in the expand the court, I think that that can have a, a backlash. But I think this is evidence that voting matters. Voting has consequences. And this is a result of not just voting at the federal level, but voting at the state level, because these cases all come through the state level and through legislation at the state level. And this has been a long march, you know, to get to this point. And they've been methodically moving cases through, you know, getting legislation at the state level and moving it through and then taking cases to the courts and moving them through. And this is what happens, you know, that the McConnell, while Trump was doing what Trump does, McConnell was packing the courts, and this is what results. And the fix on it is through the legislative process. You know, this is why we have three branches of government. And if you want to address what the Supreme Court does and you don't like it, then you pass legislation. That's going to be hard to do, but that's going to be the solution to this.
Well, it's very tough to do that, as you know, and it's very tough to override Supreme Court ever since, as you know better than most, what judicial review is all about. The mm-hmm. court gets the right to say, we know what's right, and if Congress does something we don't like, we override it. We can as a small group. And remember what's happened here. We had Obama, who tried to appoint a Supreme Court justice, and they took that right away from him, as they have done so many other, in my opinion, Hitlerian things that have occurred. And so I think, I think it would be very dramatic. But I'll tell you one thing, Teresa. If there isn't, as there was with FDR, a threat to the Supreme Court, they're not going to get out of the preeminent position that they're in right now. So I think you're right. Who wants to do that? I don't. Nobody does. On the other hand, we can't let these guys ruin the lives of so many American women and men.
Mike Spain, we haven't heard from you since the tree came down.
Timber. No, the divisiveness of the issue of legalized abortion remains a big factor here. And the timing you referenced, Ray, that, you know, the court is not going to hear this until October, and then they're not going to decide probably until maybe the spring of 2022, which will be as the midterm elections are gearing up. And the question is whether this will embolden people who are opposed to free and legalized access to abortion, or people who, are in favor of that and the rights of women to choose when it comes to their own bodies. So who will it bring out? Who will it embolden? You know, people on both sides of the fence are very strongly religious, highly moral and ethical, and they disagree about this issue. And the issue isn't going away, but polls show a majority of Americans want women to have access to legalized and safe abortions, and yet a minority party is basically calling the shots here, and that's kind of the way things are going with a lot of things right now. It's the minority telling the majority because they've gamed it.
You know, Alan, that's an interesting point. The minority, the Republican minority, it's a slim minority in Congress. How does this play if this decision doesn't come down until spring of 2022?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. One of the big problems that the Democrats have is that certain states are controlled by the Republicans. This will turn on that base, and clearly, to some degree, it will win. It's going to be a winning formula. So for the Republicans, it becomes not nationwide. That is clearly not going to happen. But for the Republicans, yes, there's a good chance that this will embolden them in the states that they need to maintain in order to do the damage that they've been doing.
Rosemary.
So what we're overlooking is the pattern that is now becoming quite clear in the Supreme Court. We expected it, and now we're seeing the results. This is we're moving to the right. They're taking cases on matters that were decided years ago, decades ago, in the case of voting rights and now abortion. They're going to overturn what has been established law. They're willing to do that. And their laws are, the new law that they're making is extremely cruel. Sonia Sotomayor is the only one speaking out about this that I know of, couched in very technical and dry terms. It's hiding the fact that workers are being ignored. Now women are being ignored. This is, it's a really, really horrible situation in the Supreme Court among very young justices who will rule for decades more. And nothing can be done about it. Republicans can rant and rave and we can talk all we want on the roundtable. Nothing is going to happen. The Democrats simply don't have the power to fix either voting rights or now abortion, women's rights. They can only talk about it until at least 2 more years. We better be paying attention to those 2022 elections and stop all this crap about Trump is out. Get over it. We are in the middle of this fight. It's the stakes are higher now, or at least as high as when Trump was in office. This is.
I want to understand something from you, Rosemary. You did say that Republicans can rant all they want about this. You meant Democrats, didn't you?
True. Yeah, Democrats can rant about we'll do this and we'll fix this. And Biden is absolutely. And Biden is saying, "No, I don't support this." But it doesn't matter. It's just words. The power is all in Republican hands, and it's years in the making. The PACs and the ecumenical groups and the organized anti-abortion foes in this case, anti-union people in other cases have been working on the state level for decades on this, and it's all coming to fruition. It's horrible to see it unfolding.
That's exactly right, Rosemary. And what was interesting to me in the New York Times article, they talk about how there are trigger laws in place in 20 states, so legislation so that when if the Supreme Court makes a decision, then it automatically changes the state laws as well. This has been a very organized, as she says, decades-long effort. They're very, very organized and very focused on the process for a long time.
So what can be done?
And make no mistake about it, this is totally oppression, because the people who are against abortions don't get abortions. They're trying to decide what women who want abortions can do.
Right.
That's a decreasing number, by the way, in the United States. It is not a crisis. And they will still get their abortions. In the 1960s, when abortion, before Roe v. Wade, and abortion was illegal in most places, women still got abortions. It is not going to stop it. And that's the whole unnecessary mess of all of this, to my mind. Group the pro-abortion, I'm not going to do that pro-life boldness, pro-life, pro-choice thing, the pro-abortion people are just as organized, and they were fundraising like crazy from yesterday when this decision to take the case came out. So nothing is going to change. If you think the Supreme Court ruling a certain way will change behavior, it will not.
Well, I just want to take some notice of what you just said. They got abortions before, but a lot of those abortions were wire hangers and very dangerous procedures, which endangered the lives of many, many Republican and Democratic women altogether, which is why I'm surprised that we're not hearing more. I mean, one wonders,
right?
I don't see that happening again.
The methods of abortion are much simpler now. They're chemical and pill-like. You don't have to use a wire hanger. And there are states, including New York, where abortion will remain a legal possibility. And so what you'll see are groups organizing to move women into places where it's legal and safe.
Michael writes, yes, Alan, a woman should be in control of her own body, but now she's responsible for another human's body. Should she be allowed to determine its fate? And that's from Michael.
Well, I do think that women have the right to regulate their own bodies. Look, Michael has a right to his opinion, but what's happened here is sort of a cheap politics that is happening to take over the court. And unlike the others on the panel, I think, you know, it's an emergency situation, and you may really have to say to the court, look, if you're going to proceed doing this kind of thing, we're going to respond draconianly, meaning we may have to change the composition of the court. I'm for it.
Yeah, I don't think that when the vote goes your way against you, I just don't think you change the fundamental structure. You have to focus on the changing the laws. I just think there's too many consequences, many of them unintended consequences. You know, just like you know, I just think you follow the process, which these folks as well.
All right, go ahead, Alan.
You're right. McConnell did not. He withheld the vote. I'm sorry, Alan. You know, on Garland, you're absolutely right. But I think there are too many unintended consequences if you...
Emails from various folks. This one's from Suzanne. Suzanne says, anti-abortion hypocrisy. I've heard anti-vaxxers say it's my body and I have the right not to take a vaccine. Yet when it comes to abortion, many of the same people say a woman has no right over her body. You can't fix stupid. And that is from Suzanne.
I like it. You can't fix stupid.
All right. This one. Anybody else want to comment on that?
Well, I want to actually go back to the last letter, which got to the heart of the cultural matter here. It's the who gets to be the primary consideration, the living human woman or the fetus, which some people regard as a potential human or even an actual human. And to me, as a feminist, there's no contest. The woman gets to make the decision. But instead, we have judges and Republican legislators who want to say that, no, we get to pick the choice of your someday baby over you. And that is the essence of the issue right there. So I'll take it on and say it's the woman gets to pick. That's it.
Well, I do think, you know, people say that they want to take away choice because they believe in the sanctity of life. And for some, I think that's a political position. You know, it's how they raise money. It's how they retain power. But for some, it is a truly held, you know, personal, often religious belief. But I think what concerns me and what you raise in connection with the vaccination issue is that how far does that belief go in terms of the sanctity of life? Does it reach to the gun cases, right? So do people then feel the same way about choices around guns because of the loss of life that guns cause? And, you know, what about the, does it reach to the policy and the funding the Saudis who are killing untold numbers of children in Yemen or any sorts of health, access to health care policy in the United States? So how far does the sanctity of life philosophy go in these questions? And I think that has to be explored as well.
You know, I agree with you, Teresa, that you know, there are people who deeply believe that in the sanctity of life and are opposed to abortion because of it. And that's a conviction that they have. But I believe politicians have learned to manipulate that. And they know when they play that the issue of abortion up, they can pull on the heartstrings of those people and the emotions of those people who are so opposed to it and get them to elect them. Get them to tolerate other things that they would otherwise not tolerate because they feel so strongly about abortion, and they are exploited by politicians who raise money because of these strong believers who are opposed to abortion, and they are manipulated and they are handled by the politicians who also claim to have those feelings, but many times I think are hypocrites for the reasons that you just said. I mean, in South Carolina, they just decided to go back to using firing squads for the death penalty, you know, and yet the same politicians are pushing to have abortions limited and outlawed. You know, there's a lot of hypocrisy out there.
Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel last Tuesday, May 18th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Wednesday's roundtable panel, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue once again welcomed Rosemary Armeo, along with Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
The president is increasingly at odds with other Democrats over Israel, coming into conflict with his fellow Democrats as he resists a shift in his party toward a tougher stand on Israel and stronger support for the Palestinians. A disconnect highlighted Tuesday by Biden's visit to a region that is a center of Arab American life in the United States. Biden traveled to the Detroit area to tour an electric vehicle plant to promote his infrastructure plan, an effort to bolster his domestic agenda at a moment of deadly conflict in the Middle East. Arab American protesters gathered at a mosque in Dearborn in advance of the visit, eager to demonstrate their anger at Biden's approach to the conflict. The president faced calls from at least one member of Congress to devote time during the trip to meet with Arab Americans, because the plant Biden visited is in an area that is 90% Arab American, but the White House announced no such meetings. Many Democrats remain staunchly supportive of Israel and the action it says it must take in self-defense. But as a growing number of Democrats urged a ceasefire over the past week, Biden for days refused to join them, waiting until after his third conversation with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to cautiously support such a move.
The answer to me is it's looking more and more like the Israelis are the holdup here. As you know, I grew up in a household which believed in the state of Israel. I've made that point many times. Nevertheless, Netanyahu is not to my liking. Put another way, him I don't like. And I have to say that the reporting that I've been reading on this says basically that the Israelis are saying, even though there are signals it's time to stop it and that the other side will stop it, that they say not yet. And that bothers me a great deal.
Everything that I'm reading is pointing towards a ceasefire, I think, if not today, then in the next couple of days. But Alan, I think you're right. I think there are military objectives that Israel feels like it has not achieved yet and wants to do before any ceasefire goes in. I am also worried about the potential expansion of violence into the north. It appears like missiles from Lebanon, which is typically Hezbollah, we could start to see an expansion of the conflict. Obviously, Middle East peace has been a dream for millennials, but if peace is going to be achieved, there both parties need to come to the table. Israel, I believe, Alan, you're correct. They have a right to exist. I also believe that the Palestinians should have a state, and we have not been able to achieve that. With that said, though, I've also been to southern Israel. I've been to Gaza. I've actually been in the tunnels the terrorists were using, and I use the term purposefully as terrorists. It's a very, very difficult, intense situation. And unless you're living there, you can't really appreciate the fear that's on both sides of the. It's a tough way to live life.
I think that Israel is engaged now and has provoked an attack and is using it to Netanyahu's political advantage. He's causing untold death and disaster, and he's getting away with it. He's getting away with it because the United States will not use its influence over Israel to stop it. All they have to do is threaten that enormous financial and military aid that we give to Israel, and it would stop right damn quick. But we're not, because it's politically dangerous for Biden to do that. We are complicit in what is going on. We just sold a whole bunch of precision military equipment to Israel. Guess where that's being used now? He's also getting away with it because of some of the sentiment that we're echoing here. Israel has a right to exist, and both sides are at fault. And none of that is in play in this current crisis, the worst since 2014. This was provoked by attacks on Muslims trying to worship in Jerusalem. It was provoked by Israel making yet another land grab in East Israel. And Hamas is definitely a terrorist organization, and it responded in desperate straits to strike back. Israel also is engaging in terrorism right now. When you kill women and children, when you bomb buildings that house media organizations, that's terrorism. It has nothing to do with protecting their borders. It has to do with oppressing people who live within their borders. And as far as Netanyahu's now, we're mowing the grass, we're keeping them at bay. That's baloney. If they could have blown out Hamas 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, they would have done it. This is just more warmongering and unnecessary death, and we are part of it.
The president has said that he expects significant de-escalation in Israel. Chris, what do you make of that, and especially with its timing?
Well, it's interesting, you know, staunch, a hallmark of our foreign policy for as long as most of us can remember has just been staunch, unwavering support, unquestioning support for Israel. And I think, at least in the Democratic Party, that is breaking down, as it should, I think. I mean, I think there's a lot to criticize in the way that Israel approaches its neighbors. I'm a little surprised that Biden has been as tepid on this as he has been, as kind of as hands off. I have to say, we talked a lot during the Trump years about kind of inappropriate behavior from the president during kind of serious moments. I thought some of the things that Biden was doing yesterday during that visit to Michigan were a little distasteful. To be joking around and acting like, you know, you're having a fun time and laughing with reporters and stuff in the middle of a crisis, that those are might as well be American bombs raining down on those civilians. I mean, we funded all that stuff. That's our weaponry in a lot of cases. And for Biden to kind of acting like it's a jokey ha-ha time out there, and I found it a bit gross. And I think if Trump had done the same thing, I think the condemnation would be raining down on him for it.
So, Rosemary, the chances of a ceasefire and with the UN and EU getting involved, what do you think?
I think the chances are high. I was really happy to see Egypt involved. The United States, of course, could have made it happen much faster, except that Biden, as Chris says, is indeed being tepid. I see this along the lines of, you know, moving away from support of fossil fuel. It takes years to move people in that direction, and slowly we're going towards it in the case of moving away from our unconditional support of Israel, which has helped to bring about this situation. I think there'll be a ceasefire. David Mondrelli of the Washington Post wrote a great story today about what should be included in that ceasefire, what terms it should be negotiated, and this should not be just tamp it down for now and then Israel proceeds on its way to cause another crisis by grabbing land in the next few weeks. It has to have some real teeth into it. The opening of talks again, the start of real negotiations for peace. And I think that will be extremely difficult because it simply is not in Netanyahu's interest right now to do that. He loves the strife. He loves the division. He's Trump of the Middle East.
I do think that the ceasefire will come faster. I think in the long term, though, it's again, we're back into this. How do we ever think about a more permanent solution? I also think that if we start to see the continued violence, I think one of the considerations that we should be make is moving our embassy back to Tel Aviv. But I also never supported the idea of moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to begin. I think that has absolutely inflamed feelings and emotions, and it has led to, it's been part of the spark that we're seeing the fire right now.
No, I've said it before. I'll say it again. Both Abbas and Netanyahu are profiteers in emotional and or vote getting in terms of what they have done. They want. They become the protectors of the people who are living in both of those areas, and it's not an easy solution, because this will help both of them. To solidify support from all those people who think that the tough road is the way to go. There will be many who believe that, Israel is wrong in this. But I have a feeling that the White House is polling and that they're finding that is not the case in terms of the American public opinion. So you have to factor all of that in when you figure on this decision. I agree with everybody who has said that this is going to be relatively short-lived. It will be over. I don't think that Washington Post or not, that the Israelis are going to be perceived as the losers who have to give in here.
Well, Alan, if that's true, that the White House is polling on this, and I don't doubt it. I mean, that's part of the problem, right? This is always done with politics in mind. It's not. I think Biden and a lot of Democrats are realizing that the sands are shifting, and they're spending too much time worrying about what's politically positive for them instead of worrying about, you know, the humanitarian disaster or the long-term consequences of what's happening right now. You know, I understand everything is political in a sense. You know, going back to what we were talking about with masks, but I just don't think that you rely on a poll to tell you what to do in a situation like this.
Well, probably
we have blood on our hands.
One of the best presidents that we have had in our recent history was Jimmy Carter, who tended, as you have suggested, to say, let's do what's right, as opposed to let's do what's political. And you see what the play is there. So I agree with you. You know, you want to do what's right. But on the other hand, you better believe that politics will always rear its ugly head.
Go ahead, Chris, and then Rosemary. Go ahead.
Just as evidence of how the politics have shifted, Chuck Schumer has been almost completely silent on this. Chuck Schumer, one of the staunchest defenders of Israel, a senator who very vocally supported the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, has gone quiet. And, you know, it shows you how the dynamics are shifting in the Democratic Party. If even Chuck Schumer is hesitant to come out and fully voice support for Israel.
Well, the other thing I want to say is that politics are shifting not just in the United States and the Democratic Party, but in Israel. There's a significant movement in Israel to say we're unfair, this is wrong, what we're doing to the Palestinians, and that feeds into this too. Unfortunately, it isn't strong enough to defeat Netanyahu, but they have messed him up from forming a government for the past few years, which is why he's now coming down super, super hard, and that is benefiting him, and it's just all so wrong. But I do see a movement. I think that we didn't pay attention to apartheid for a long time. This is another form of apartheid in Israel right now. We supported land grabs. And as for Jimmy Carter doing right and only having one term, Trump did everything wrong, including in the Middle East. And he also only lasted one term.
Chris.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, politics are shifting around the world on this. I mean, in Britain, you're seeing soccer players, football players carrying Palestinian flags onto the field, onto the pitch as they, you know, prepare for a match. I mean, I think around the world, there's a lot of outrage at what Israel is doing right now. And, you know, Israel's in a tough spot. I don't want to make it sound like you know, that they're the evil doer here, and that Hamas is guilt free. It's a situation where it's tough to decide. It's tough to come down on either side because it's difficult to. Neither party is very. What's the word I'm looking for? Plus, you know, it's hard to root for.
Yeah.
There's no innocence in this fight. There's blood on both hands.
Exactly.
We go to Gary. The phrase right to exist regarding Israel recalls our own dilemma of rights versus responsibilities. I'm almost exactly as old as Israel, and I know the international community, mainly the U.S., created Israel on shared turf and then walked away from any responsibility to ensure the rights of who was already there. The problem is the responsibility, not the right. That from Gary. We go to Judy. Why are the tunnels?
Before you go on, Joe, I would put more of that on the British and how they pulled out of Palestine. And I don't know. I think that letter it ignores an awful lot of history. And if you think about the birth of the state of Israel, the fight for survival. You know, what was happening and has happened in that region, the fact that they still have neighbors that deny their very right for them to exist as a people. When you add on the rise in anti-Semitic attacks that we're seeing right now in places like Europe, there are a lot of other,
yeah.
that doesn't excuse it doesn't excuse violence or inhumanity. So, I mean, at the same time, I'm a huge supporter, and I'm absolutely, you know, support Israel and hate anti-Semitism. But I don't use that to excuse all the behaviors of the government. But we did talk about that, Joe.
All right, let's go to Leah. I shudder whenever Rosemary gives her takes on Israel. She may think she knows what she is talking about, but she needs to have a lot more sensitivity and substance on the issue and cannot make blanket statements. Hamas does not want peace. It wants Israel gone, period. Too bad Netanyahu is not helpful in his own state. That is followed by Joseph, who says, so refreshing to hear Rosemary, who says it like it is. Israel's actions are horrifying, and we are complicit. Deanne said, I may be wrong, but I have a feeling that the Israeli violent attacks in Jerusalem against the Palestinians when they were celebrating Ramadan sparked this reaction on the part of the Palestinians. Does no one ever talk about that? That from
not here, but Rosemary does. Yes, my friends in Jordan absolutely do. That's why this is not religious. This is the Israeli government is the one that we fault, and Arabs know that distinction. However, what provoked this was a religious attack. It was stopping Muslim worshipers in the temple and the mount in East Jerusalem. I mean, it's just like poking the fire with a rod, and that's what the Netanyahu government did. It is so difficult for me to be sympathetic to them right now when they walked right into this. And then to say, oh, we've never gotten along. That's what it is. It's not. This is a new and different provocation. And it would be so good if we could just keep that all clear in our heads.
So, Rosemary, do you see Abbas as a peacemaker?
Do I see who as a peacemaker?
Hamas.
No, yeah. I see them.
No, right.
I see them as a terrorist organization in the same way that Al Qaeda was in the Middle East and caused by almost the same thing: incredible poverty and oppression and desperation and no other method. Gaza is like an open air prison. It's horrible. You cannot get medical care there. They don't have clean water. They don't have clean sewage. So yeah, they're joining a terrorist group. Wow. Where have we seen that before? American policy in Iraq did it. American policy is helping to continue that in Israel. These are not unrelated events. And absolutely, Hamas, I don't approve of them. Chris is right. There are no good players on the Palestinian side. There might have been a two-state solution had it not been for Palestinian leaders who sabotage it. No question about it. But there are innocents in this, and they are the people of Gaza, the Palestinians, and also the Israeli people who have to live in fear of groups like Hamas. But make no mistake about it, it's a dual responsibility, including by Israel, which we continue too often to support without question.
Judy writes, go ahead, Bob.
No, so Rosemary, if you view Hamas as a terrorist organization, and you just made a comparison with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Do you think then that there should be a regime change, even if it involves the military in Gaza?
Military by what? The Israelis to stop them? No, I think that that's why a peace talk that actually led to real negotiations would empower the Palestinians in a way they never had been. And Trump did that too. He just simply cut Palestine out of any of the considerations. He cut off all aid. He moved the embassy, which was one of the major things that they wanted. They want East Jerusalem to be a capital of their state. He cut off all hope that there would ever be a two-state solution. And so are we surprised? Should we be surprised that young men who have absolutely no hope for a future are joining Hamas, who are taking up Hamas as opposed to a civilian government? I'm not condoning it, but the causes of Hamas being as powerful as it has been are very, very clear to see. And Israel is partly to be responsible, and so is the United States.
I think you're ignoring the whole issue of the Palestinian government in the West Bank. The fact that they and Hamas don't get along, I do think you're whitewashing Hamas's responsibility for the current conditions in Gaza. This is
Hamas has no control. Hamas has no control over the conditions in Gaza.
How can you say that, Rosemary? Hamas is armed, that is the ruling government in Gaza.
It doesn't have any power though. The power in Gaza is Israel. It is not Hamas. Hamas is a reactionary force, a horrible reactionary force. But power is in the hands of the Israelis, and they have cut off so much aid, so much. There's no economic development. There are no jobs. There's nothing in Gaza. It's a horrible place. That certainly makes a breeding ground for an organization like Hamas. And I do not condone the government of Palestine is ridiculous, and it has been for decades. There's no question about that. They have been ill-served by their governments, too. But it's not an excuse for what's going on now. It's not an excuse for Israel to go in and say, okay, we want East Jerusalem land, too. It's not equal or fair, and desperate people take on actions that we're seeing now.
Rosemary Armeo on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 19th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuc. On Thursday, May 20th, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok spoke with Albany Chief City Auditor Dorothea Pleers, Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius Kelly, and Dr. Carolina Gonzalez, Assistant Dean in the College of Education and Human Services at Montclair State University.
Let's begin with the January 6th Commission. And that is what's going on, and the strangest there. So the House has passed a bill to create a commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol, but its chances in the Senate are dim. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, the Republican from Kentucky, came out against the bill yesterday, this after Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, came out and said he was also against the measure. He said he opposes the legislation because it is a slanted and unbalanced proposal. A day after he said his members were open to voting for the plan but needed a chance to read the quote-unquote fine print. In between those comments, former President Donald Trump released a statement Tuesday evening slamming the bill and decrying it as a Democrat trap while urging McConnell and other GOP leaders to start listening. It's not at all clear what new facts or additional investigation yet another commission could actually lay on top of existing efforts by law enforcement and Congress, McConnell said on the floor Wednesday. Several question marks remain about the attack, however, including to what degree it was coordinated, as well as details about what Trump was doing while it was taking place. The House vote, just for those of you keeping track at home, 252 to 175. Dr. Alan Shartok, your thoughts.
Well, we do know that it's probably going to be doomed in the United States Senate, where the anthropologists have found evidence of, human beings without spines. So what can I tell you except that it could be good news for the Democrats, because the Democrats say, well, we tried to do this. We offered similar numbers of Republicans and Democrats on the commission. All of America saw what was going on. Your lies about how it was just a bunch of people coming in to look at the Capitol the way all tourists look at the Capitol. Yeah, with the windows being busted and all of the rest.
Right.
It is the big lie over and over and over again. You just better believe that that's what's happening. I think the Democrats are going to win, maybe not among the Republicans, but they're going to win among the neutrals, all of whom saw it.
Very curious, Kelly, do you think that the concern here among the Republicans is that they'll find out more about just how bad this was?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is an embarrassing chapter for the Republican Party, and I find it so interesting that the whole split within the Republican Party is becoming wider and wider. It's been brewing for a while, and the fact that the Republican House Homeland Security Committee supported this effort in investigation into the January 6th events also shows that there is a growing separation between Republicans interested in fully disclosing and showing more transparency towards who was involved in organizing these events and to what extent the former president and members, perhaps, of the Republican Senate senators participated in these events or coordinated in parts of these events. So this is a very interesting moment for the Republican Party. I think it will show over time that we will either see a split to the extent of a separating out of members of the Republican Party to form a new party, or it will sink the Republican Party if it sticks overwhelmingly with the big lie approach to what took place with the election and the January 6th events.
Carolina.
Yes, I mean, I think to Vera's point, it if anything, this tells us that Trump is very much present in the Republican Party and influencing it as well. And there's clearly continued loyalty to him. I mean, Mitch McConnell attributed the attacks on January 6th to Trump's leadership. And now he seems to be backtracking and softening his tone. So as my colleague mentioned, the Republican Party is almost in an identity crisis, right? And is trying to reconcile who they are and who they want to be with what they want to accomplish. And they don't know necessarily how to get there. And at the moment, they're thinking Trump is the way to do it. Maybe it's because of money coming in, maybe it's because of influence. But right now, I think that the American public is confused, right? I don't know if they know what exactly does the Republican Party stand for and stand behind.
It's a very interesting point of that idea of an identity crisis. Fran Berman.
You know, I don't know. I mean, you all know that, you know, my heart belongs to the public interest. And so, you know, I see something like this where, you know, all of the strategies, all of them have to do with politics. You know, they have to do with, you know, have we positioned ourselves and do we want to be, you know, on the record for a vote? You know, there was some suggestions about kitchen sinking, investigation of protests at racial justice rallies. It's just, you know, all of this is just political strategizing. And really what the commission ought to be about is to figure out, you know, what happened. How did it happen? How can we prevent it from happening again? How can we protect the people we elect as our public servants, no matter what party they're in? You know, sort of unpolitical, reasonable things like that. And I don't know. You know, I look at something like this and, you know, my heart sinks a little bit lower because there are so many opportunities to see my heart sink for, you know, all of these very, very partisan perspectives.
So just to add what has already been mentioned, you know, I think it's easy to lose sight of the real issue here because there's so many layers to this. And from my perspective, you know, the crux of the issue here is politics, of course, the pursuit of power, and white supremacy. And I think that our country's history of just turning a blind eye to issues related to race, it is being perpetuated here. And so you have casualties of war, the Capitol Police, the staff of the legislators who were there that day, the legislators. And so the crux of the problem for me, or the crux of the issue for me, is really politics, pursuit of power, and white supremacy. And as Catalina mentioned, Vera mentioned, these notions of all eyes on our democracy, this identity crisis of the Republican Party, I think it's really an identity crisis of our country. And for the average person looking in, you know, whether it's the Republicans choosing not to vote for this commission, people are asking themselves, can I trust, can I have faith in this democracy? And the way things look, it looks very dim at the moment.
It does look dim, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's dim, but not. I mean, let's face it. Joe Biden won the presidency by, what, 7 or 8 million votes.
Correct.
Over his opponent. And one just says, all right, has that coalition that came together to elect him dissipated, or has it grown stronger? Now, I think one could make an argument either way, but I think it's actually grown stronger. For example, his numbers are in the high 50s and mid 50s and high 50s. And the other guy who keeps saying he's going to run for president, and who has been indicated is a racist, is in the 30s. So the Republicans are scared to death for their individual offices, worrying about this president turning on them. He called in a play and said, we don't want this commission. We're not going to have this commission. And everybody said yes, and they did exactly what they were told. So they could feel good about it, but the American people and the independents in the middle will not feel good about it.
Do you think, Vera, let's go to you on this, but do you think that we will see what impact? I mean, obviously, one of the questions, the big questions, is what impact this will have on the House elections just next year, which seems impossible to think of. But yes, indeed, it's a year plus away, and everybody's already lining up of what impact that will have.
I'm not clear that all these finer moments and the gamesmanship and all these decisions, we can already judge what the impact will be, because I think we have to look at the compounding effect. What voters pay more attention to is their pocketbook issues. The fact if in fact we don't have additional COVID problems in the fall, what travel looks like. I mean, there's so many other factors, I think, that matter more to the vast majority to Americans. The only exception I would make to that are these constant restrictions to voting right issues. Those are issues that people are deeply concerned about and paying close attention to. This kind of voting right now that we see on what we will likely see in the Senate on the January 6th commission, that is almost expected for the current state of the Republicans. So nobody will really be that surprised. What will matter is how it affects communities and individual voters' lives, I think. Once we see real impact in terms of economic recovery, opening of schools, opportunities for young people, unemployment rates, those are the compounding factors, in my view, that will determine the outcome of the next election or the congressional elections.
Vera, just back to you for one second here. You're a brilliant political scientist. I know that. And I wanted to ask you whether or not, in your mind, There are so many other factors in terms of answering Joe's very good question. In other words, districts all around the country, because more legislatures are Republican than Democrat, have been gerrymandered like crazy. Mm-hmm. So you may have a Biden with a, you know, a 50-something percent approval rating or a 60% approval rating, and you compare that with Trump's 30%, well, you would think there'd be no problem in terms of the Congress staying blue. But because of the machinations of the gerrymander and everything else, that's by no means assured, right?
You're correct. Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly it. I mean, the real struggles are happening on the grassroots level, township by township, you know, county by county, electoral district by electoral district. This is where all of the, you know, voters will have to pay very close attention to what is developing. And I have to say, from my limited perspective here in the Albany area and upstate New York, I am not sure this is happening. I think people are not paying close enough, voters are not paying close enough attention in general to what is happening. They're so focused on their personal recovery and return to a sense of normalcy. Many, many of my students, my neighbors, even, you know, community members I chat with at farmers markets, they're tuned out. They're exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, you know, I agree with you in terms of voters not paying attention, especially to, you know, the voter suppression efforts that have been ramped up, mostly because we just went through an election that really took all of our energy, right? Like there was so much, you know, it was very divisive, but there was also a lot of emotional labor that went into it for a lot of people for many reasons. We were in the middle of the pandemic and still are, but hopefully getting out of it soon. So, you know, to think about the midterm election coming up is way back in people's minds. I think that the impact is, you know, we've seen already the impact of what has been going on with grassroots efforts continuing to ramp up, the way that Stacey Abrams rallied voters in Georgia and across the country as well. So I think we'll see a lot more of that, and that's how folks are being informed for the folks who it's impacting. And I only with those efforts, I believe that we will see a little bit more engagement in the elections, because we see how important it is to not only vote in a primary, but, you know, vote across the board whenever there is an election coming up.
You know, I really agree with that, because I think that when you think about, are you voting for this commission or anything else, you're trying to optimize for playing the game. But I think, as Vera and Alan said, when you suppress voting, when you're really changing the game itself, and you're changing the game itself so that, you know, individuals, groups, participation doesn't matter. And not only is that important for us as citizens, but, you know, our voices have so little influence in so many ways. There's so much money in the system. There's so much power to big corporations in the system. You know, there's so many important influences in the system that our real influence is deciding who's in the system, at least to some extent. And when we can't do that in a full way, we're really in trouble. And so I agree with that. You know, I agree with, you know, there's very little that's more important than ensuring that, you know, however you play the game, it's a fair game. It's a game where everybody can participate in whatever ways the system allows us to.
Fran Berman on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, May 20th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.